First this hour to one of the most significant developments in our region, but one rather sidelined. My other sensationalised emotions here in Australia? No, not Barnaby Joyce et al., but I'm talking of the planned changes to the Chinese constitution, removing any limits on President Xi Jinping's tenure as leader, usually just two terms of 5 years. Whereas the emotions I'm referring to were those flying around in the wake of Canberra writer Clive Hamilton's new book, Silent Invasion, showcasing his acute concerns around supposed Chinese infiltration into Australia, which has provoked an enormous amount of reaction, too numerous to itemise here. Graham Richardson's column response in Wednesday's Australian was characteristically blunt, I thought, suggesting that the Hamilton work evoked the old yellow peril fears that he could remember from the nuns at primary school. But there are different nuances coming through. Paul Dibb was on with Linda Mottram last night on PM with a whole different invitation. Well, there were some pivotal developments in China this week. A high-profile Chinese energy entrepreneur, Ye Jianming, with known military connections, was detained for questioning. And another businessman from the insurance industry, Wu Xiaohui, has been charged with economic crimes. And all this in the backdrop of the changes, planned changes to the constitution. Jeff Raby usually watches this up close from his offices in Beijing, but he's been visiting Australia this week for board meetings, and we thought we'd tap his insights about the Xi moves. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Geraldine. Good to be back.
Did you see this coming?
Well, in all modesty, yes. Back in 2015, in October, when the Xi Jinping had a major military parade, which is the first time a parade had been held on that occasion, the 70th anniversary of the defeat over Japan, it seemed then that this was a very different leader. He was not going to be bound by precedent and tradition and customary forms of behaviour. He was very much his own man and going to make his own way. And we've seen a succession of things by him which has shown that he's not bound by the precedent of previous leaders. For example, he's imprisoned some members of the Standing Committee, like Zhou Yongkang. That's never happened with a standing, or just retired rather, Standing Committee member has been in prison, or a member of the Central Committee, Bo Xilai. And on various occasions we've seen this, most recently last October, when at the 19th Party Congress, he did not appoint a successor. And so this is very much, I think, in a pattern of Xi. And quite clearly for him, 2022, when he's supposed to retire, it means a question of who will he be able to trust to look after him and his family, not just for a few years, but for a generation, perhaps.
So let's just go back for a moment. What was the significance of that parade you mentioned, the China's defeat of Japan? I think a lot of listeners would think, well, yes, what's so amazing about that?
It was completely a break with precedent. In a 10-year term, a leader has one military parade. The tradition started back with Deng Xiaoping, and that is to celebrate the founding of the People's Republic. And 2015 is not in sequence. Xi will most definitely have another parade in 2019 to celebrate the anniversary of the founding of the People's Republic.
Okay, so also maybe you could contextualise the break with Deng Xiaoping, which you make quite a lot of in your recent writing, that this is what's so striking about these decisions, is that it's broken a four-decade pattern of abiding by Deng Xiaoping's victims. Now, why do they matter?
Well, because Deng and his successors set about trying to institutionalise the transfer of power in a one-party state. The reality is that the party is above the law. Whatever's written in the constitution doesn't mean anything much. It doesn't have much force, or any force really, because the standing committee or the leader can change the rules and what's written when he wishes. So what Deng tried to do to avoid the chaos that ensued at the end of the Mao period was to try and institutionalise the transfer of power. And to a large extent, he pulled off a pretty remarkable trick. Remember that in one-party states, there's only three ways, really, to transfer power, either dynastically, as we see in North Korea, or through atrophy, waiting for the leader to die whilst the whole system grinds to a halt. Thirdly, and most commonly, violently. China found, over the last several decades, a fourth way, which was to accept the fiction, if you like, that there were rules controlling the transfer of power, and then to behave as if those rules had force. And so we got into thinking about 2 5-year terms, a maximum of 10 years for a leader, and then there would be a smooth transition of power. And that's how it's been right up until now. But this constitutional change last Sunday changes all of that. So he throws the precedent and the attempts to institutionalise transfer out the window.
So what do you, in your judgment, is this a sign of extraordinary strength or something rather more brittle, as you've hinted at?
Well, the analysts are divided, and it goes to the opaque nature of the Chinese political system at the elite level. No one really knows. But one school of thought has it that he's all-powerful. No one's been as powerful as Xi since Mao Zedong. And he can do what he wishes, and he's just changed the constitution to suit his own ambitions. Another school of thought is that he feels vulnerable and feels as if he may not be able to, in the normal course of events, stay on beyond the customary term, and so decided to act now whilst he could.
Because, as you point out, really all his opponents are really in prison, aren't they? Which is something that isn't necessarily seen as such overseas.
No, as far as we know. That's the opaque nature of the system. You only really know who the opponents are once they've been outed and brought down. And we saw that in a very striking, extraordinary way, which does suggest there is some degree of unsettled turmoil at the centre. When in the 3 weeks leading up to the 19th Party Congress last year, when everything should be settled down and all the changes made well in advance, the very powerful party secretary of Chongqing, Sun, was himself brought down and just recently has been charged with bribery and corruption. Hmm. Now, that was a major event because no one saw it coming, no one expected it. Sun had been appointed under Xi Jinping to that position. But quite clearly, again, either Xi felt so strong he could bring down someone who may be a potential competitor or challenger, or he felt vulnerable and felt he had to clear him out of the way before the Congress started.
Now, the Australian Financial Review wrote an editorial this week, "To a brash president in Washington, we must now add an empowered autocrat in Beijing. Asia's new middle class remains the world's best economic story. We still live in the right time and place to prosper from it, but the chances of a political upset are also rising, and Australia must learn to manage them too." I wonder if you agree and what your advice would be to people who might be thinking of dealing with China.
Well, the first part of the question is easy, Jordan. Yes, and I've again been saying this publicly and in my writings for some time, that people get focused on the economic risks in China, debt and so on, but really they can manage most of those economic issues. The real risks in China are on the political side, and I think they've just been increased substantially as a result of this constitutional change last Sunday. The political system is becoming more brittle because it's becoming less institutionalised, and it means that what have been mechanisms that have been generally accepted by the leadership to transfer power now no longer exist. And so how else will power be transferred? And it will make the elite political contest much sharper and I think more destabilising over time.
And when's all this going to happen in the next 5 years?
Well, that depends on really very much how strong she actually is. And again, it's very hard to guess that standing outside elite circles. And what do we do about it? Well, we can't do anything, of course. It is what it is. But we have to be aware and be on the lookout for signs and indications that there could be turbulence or more turbulence at the centre of the system and be prepared for shocks. What I would say, though, I'm no sinologist, so I'm not talking my own book, but what I would say is it does point once again to the need to invest in high-quality sinology in Australia and to ensure that we have people that really do understand how the system operates In most fundamental ways.
Look, final question. The nature of the debate in Australia at the moment, of course, is not cool and dispassionate about China. And you probably know about the book that's been released by Clive Hamilton this week. He was interviewed on Breakfast about it on February the 7th, called Silent Invasion. And as various people, including Bob Carr, have said in our program, it puts Australia's 1 million Australian Chinese citizens in a very difficult spot. How would you advise the average engaged person to think about this swirling debate at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think the way it's being thrashed out in a very public and increasingly emotional way is very unhelpful. That's my first point. Second point is this whole issue of Chinese influence in Australia really needs to be put in some sort of context and not be allowed to gather momentum as a scare campaign or even worse, to slip into perhaps incipient racism. Sure, there are real issues that need to be debated and understood publicly, but I think we're getting close to a point where the debate is starting to get a momentum that makes it very shrill and could be very harmful to our interests.
Geoff Raby, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
My pleasure, Geraldine.
Geoff Raby.